As soon as I heard research as ceremony, learning ceremonies, the concept of that really jives with me because they seem like such disparate ideas in my head. And I can feel in me this pull towards things that feel contradictory because often if you dig in a little bit more, they really only feel contradictory because we've been conditioned to think about them in certain ways. Hi, welcome back to Wild Geese. I'm your host, Anna, and I'm really excited about today's topic. To me, it kind of calls back to the digital gardening episode, if you watched that, or the rabbit holes episode where we talked about how to go down a rabbit hole of curiosity. This episode definitely has its own, like, je ne sais quoi, though, so I don't think that I'm going to be repeating myself a bunch. Today, I'm going to be talking about how to learn. If you have been in the same online spheres as me in the past few months, you've probably seen the personal curriculum trend that's been going around. I am definitely late to this, as I love to be to a trend. I did not actually build a personal curriculum in the same way that I saw a lot of people doing online, even though I really love that trend and I love to watch people create theirs. And if you have no idea what I'm talking about, there are a lot of people online right now that are creating personal curriculums for themselves, complete with books that they're going to read, classes that they're going to take, final projects that they're going to do. I was definitely more of a lurker with this trend than a participator, even though I love learning because I just didn't see how I could make it work for my life. I mean, people were giving themselves like full-on college curriculums, which is so cool. If you have the time and the energy and the motivation to do that, you should do that. That's awesome. But my thing is, I rebel against the rules that I set for myself if I set too many of them. When I was in school, I was doing all of my coursework because I had to. And I think that if I set a curriculum that I then felt beholden to for months on end, I would actually just end up kind of resenting the learning process in the end. So I want to chat about why I think that personal curriculums and self-led learning is having such a moment right now. And then I want to give you some other strategies if the personal curriculum was not something that you could see yourself sticking to, or you didn't feel like you could really translate it to fit your life, even if you wanted to. Because I genuinely think learning something new is like one of the most surefire ways for me to pull myself out of a feeling of like malaise or aimlessness. When I have those moments where I tap into a real sense of awe, where I'm sitting there and I'm like, oh my God, like there's so much that I don't know. That's incredible. Like, God, I just wish I could have more time so that I could figure out more. Like, there are so many mysteries in this world. Learning something new feels like opening a door that was previously locked. When I tap into that feeling, I feel so alive. But I know that there are a lot of roadblocks between me and that feeling. That's why it makes me so happy to see things like the personal curriculum trend. But I also want to dig into it a little bit more because the personal curriculum trend is great for people that like really, really loved school and the way that it was structured. But for the people that don't feel as like lit up and pulled towards that structure, it's interesting to me to think about how we can reframe the experience for ourselves. As adults, we actually have such a cool opportunity to learn outside of those structures. And what might that look like? So I'm excited to dig into that. And I'm happy to say that today's episode is sponsored by Brilliant, a platform that has personally helped me click with concepts that were really hard to grapple with while I was in school. Brilliant helps you excel in math and computer science with visual, interactive problem solving, and personalized practice. The thing is, everyone can be a math person. It's the way that we learn math that makes it so confusing and hard. That's why I love that Brilliant doesn't just focus on memorizing formulas. It actually helps you get hands-on with concepts until they make sense. You learn through active problem solving, a method that research has shown to be far more powerful than watching lectures or videos. The practice sets and reviews are personalized to start at your level and go at your pace. I've been going through the percentages course because I honestly had forgotten so much of that, and it's kind of an essential skill for a business owner. I feel like it's really helping me to develop the intuition to solve the problems myself. And I also really appreciate that the course is designed to be transferable to everyday situations. To learn for free on Brilliant, scan the QR code on screen or click the link in the episode description. Brilliant's also given our viewers 20% off of a premium annual subscription, which gives you unlimited daily access to everything on Brilliant. I saw a TikTok a while ago by this woman, Dalia Quintanilla, who is the founder of Liberated Learning and the Lighthouse Learning Model, which we'll talk about later in this episode. But she had this video about learning ceremonies to decolonize education, and I've been thinking about it ever since. Our model for education in the Western world is typically rooted in punitive measures and hierarchies that actually undermine the learning process. Dalia talks about throwing out things like grade standards and even subjects because, in her own words, those things are fully colonized. And it makes sense because if you think about it, settler colonialism is the thing that forced Indigenous children into residential schools where they were basically plucked out of their homes and then abused and made to assimilate and lose their language language. And even you think about the school to prison pipeline, that's carceral colonialism that's playing out in our school systems. I really admire the work that Dahlia is doing to reintroduce Indigenous wisdom into learning practices and like introduce this to children in a school setting. But for us adults that are looking to be self-led in our learning, I think it's a real opportunity to rethink what learning looks like. Like now without those structures, it doesn't have to directly reflect what it looked like while we were in school with these curriculums that are separated by subject. And don't get me wrong, like if the building a personal curriculum in the same way that the curriculums were built in school, if that lights a fire in you to go and learn something, then do that, whatever gets you there. But for me, it personally just, it doesn't do it for me. And if you're thinking to yourself, like, why would I do any of this? This sounds like a drag. I don't want to be back in school. I left school for a reason. I could totally see how this could sound boring to somebody that doesn't want to go and read a bunch of textbooks or something. But I want you to ask yourself if you have complained about brain rot in the past few months. And if the answer to that question is yes, this episode applies to you because your brain is literally begging for some more engagement. I read an essay by Naomi Alderman called Are You Asking Enough of Your Brain? And she was talking about how when the Industrial Revolution came along, people had to start thinking like, okay, how am I going to get movement in my day, because that used to be baked into their entire world. Like everything was manual labor, and suddenly it wasn't in the same way. In fact, if they had a problem, it was more about how to get enough rest, not how to get enough exercise in a day. So we went and we invented a bunch of things to get that physical exercise, gyms, SoulCycle, running clubs, all of that. We had to make sure that our muscles didn't atrophy. The same applies now with our brains. It's actually like counterintuitively genuinely exhausting when you don't give your mind enough to do. It's kind of akin to the physical experience of not moving and then being sore from not doing enough. Or like if you try to move too slowly, it's almost painful for your body to move slower than it wants to. And this goes beyond generative AI, like taking over tasks that we are cognitively able to do, things like writing emails, editing papers, whatever, taking over those things to cause less friction. That's one thing that's like obviously being relentlessly pushed on all of us to lighten the cognitive load right now. But it's also just the nature of the content that we're consuming. The more long form, harder to digest content used to be the free content, and then you would have to actually pay for the lighter stuff. Easy to digest, more entertainment based magazines, you would have to pay for those. You needed to pace yourself. Every time you reached the end of the magazine, you would have to go and pay for another. But the long form books were free at the library. And obviously we still have libraries, but they're not being prioritized in our funding the same way. You can't often actually find what you need at the time that you need it. Now it's the light stuff that's free. You can scroll and scroll and scroll literally forever. But then if you want the long form, juicier stuff, the stuff that takes a while to chew on, usually you have to pay for that, whether it's a subscription or a one-time fee. She says the serious stuff tends to be expensive. The light content is free and literally never ending. So this brain rot is like a function of the system. It's not a bug. Ew, that sounded like ChatGPT coming out of my mouth. Do you ever say something and you're like, yeah, that sounded like a robot? Anyways, Naomi says this is what's going on with what people call brain rot. You're being pushed towards looking basically always at stuff that is much too easy for you. So very much too easy that you are keeping on going for the occasional glimmer of something interesting. Swipe, swipe, swipe. I actually think constantly engaging with stuff that is too easy for you is demoralizing and exhausting. It is tiring trying to think down to a level that's beneath you. And this absolutely feels true. I feel like half the time when I'm scrolling on TikTok, I'm like ravenously looking for something to hold on to. And then when I do, I'm like saving it to a folder, watching it three times, trying to dig in more. I mean, like half of why I started this podcast is because I was going through that process. And then I was like, okay, no, I need to like get caught on one of these things and really dig in, even if I'm forcing myself to do that. Because this loop of scrolling and maybe finding one or two videos in a 20-minute segment that actually catch my attention and actually feel like worthy of digging my teeth into, but then not actually digging my teeth in, just being like, oh, cool, and swiping to the next, hoping to find more depth, that is not working. Naomi says, God, I cannot tell you how good it feels to make sure you're working at your intellectual edge for at least a good portion of the day. We think it's going to feel bad and difficult because maybe we remember feeling humiliated at school when we answered a question wrong. But it doesn't feel like that as an adult. It feels as great as going for a walk or a swim. It's movement for your brain. And it's so true. I always feel like I'm going to feel exhausted at the end of the day of researching for these episodes. And I don't. I might feel exhausted after recording these episodes, but researching for these episodes, absolutely not. I do feel exhausted after a full day of that, like, quote unquote, light content that she was talking about. I actually got a comment yesterday from someone saying, I love this podcast, but it does feel mentally exhausting to think critically about these topics. And I honestly took that as a compliment. I hope that I'm giving you something to, like, work your mental muscles on. I just always think it's more gratifying and has a more, like, long-term feeling of satiation to try hard to understand something and maybe feel exhausted by the end versus flipping through short-form content that's not actually satiating my hunger for knowledge and then feel exhausted at the end but feel like I didn't gain anything in the process. There's a quote from the book The Once and Future King where the magician Merlin is trying to, like, shape Arthur, who's, like, the soon-to-be king, like, shape his moral fiber, whatever. And this quote says, "The best thing for being sad is to learn something. That is the only thing that never fails. You may grow old and trembling in your anatomies. You may lie awake at night listening to the disorder of your veins. You may miss your only love. You may see the world about you devastated by evil lunatics or know your honor trampled in the sewers of baser minds. There is only one thing there is, then, to learn. Look at what a lot of things there are to learn. You can learn astronomy in a lifetime, natural history in three, literature in six. And then after you have exhausted a million lifetimes in biology and medicine and theocriticism and geography and history and economics, why, you can start to make a cartwheel out of the appropriate wood or spend 50 years learning to begin to learn to beat your adversary at fencing. After that, you can start again on mathematics until it is time to learn to plow." So I don't know. I've always thought that that little passage is so cute. And I hope it makes you more excited about engaging in the learning process. I know it does for me. But of course, there is an accessibility problem when we talk about learning outside of school. I've seen some people talk about education as a class problem as if that's new because of our over-reliance on technology. So, like, you know, the conversation around generative AI really being pushed in schools that have less funding versus in more affluent schools, it's not being pushed the same way. Or, like, the instances of tech CEOs not even letting their own children use the technology that they've put out into the world because they know that it's harmful in some way to a children's developing mind. I'm glad people are talking about these things, but like I said, education being a class issue is not a new thing. Education has always been a class issue, and I want to acknowledge that engaging in self-led learning is itself a privilege, even if it's done for free. Like, if you're working 70 to 80 hours a week, it would be insane for anyone to expect you to come home and then do a whole personal curriculum on top of that. Or, like, if you have a learning disability that wasn't addressed in childhood, there might be some real trauma around learning something new that needs to be addressed. I could go on and on, but, like, even if you are doing this for free, which there are definitely ways to do this entirely for free, it's important to have grace for yourself in whatever stage of life that you're in. Like, I was talking to someone this past week who has a child with a disability, a job, and she's getting her PhD. And she was telling me how she never finds time in her day to just learn new things for fun. And I was like, well, of course you don't. I don't know anyone who would in your position. So I just say that because, I don't know, I don't want you to use this episode to beat yourself up if you are at a place in your life where any of this feels overwhelming. Take what works for you and leave what doesn't. There is no one size fits all, and you'll need to experiment with and adjust any of the tips that I'm about to give you. Like, this past week, I posted about one of the tips that I'm going to give later in the episode on my Instagram story, and someone responded to it and said, "I saw this too. I thought about implementing it, but then when I thought about it, I didn't know if it would become another rule for myself that would make it harder for me to stay committed to what I'm doing." And then she asked, like, how do we know what is good advice to take and what's not? And the only answer to that question is that you have to see what works for you. You have to go try it out and then adjust it when it's not working. There are so many people that are going to tell you this is the way to do things. I've unlocked some secret code and you can try it out. And then if it doesn't work for you, you have to move on instead of thinking that it's some, like, personal failure for you. If someone tells you their writing process and you try out their writing process and something just isn't sticking, try something else. But the only way to know if that advice that you're hearing is good advice or not is to try it. For me, it might help me to go to a coffee shop and be in a loud environment as I'm doing my reading. For you, you might be like, oh, hell no, I need to be at home. I need silence. That doesn't make your process or my process more correct. And Sarah Schauer has a Substack post called How to Start Researching as a Hobby, where she talks about building an enemies to lovers arc with education if you were a person that really didn't like school. She says when you're falling in love, you want to know more about them. The same thing will happen with learning, researching. Also, if you have a learning disability or difficulty, think of accommodations as a modified workout. If you need to walk, aka listen to audiobooks passively, not run, aka listen to audiobooks actively, do it. And this process of thinking about thinking is called metacognition. And metacognition can be very empowering as a learner because you need to have the mechanism to like reflect on what's working and what's not as you're trying to learn, especially when you're not working with a teacher's voice that can reflect those things back to you. Metacognition empowers you to teach yourself. So knowing this, how can we start to think about thinking differently? We're finally getting to the strategies. I know you were probably like, girl, get to the point. Tell me what I can do to learn differently. Okay, so Dalia Quintanilla, the person that I was talking about before, she has a framework around something called learning ceremonies. There's a whole book about this, actually. It's called Research as Ceremony, Indigenous Research Methods by Sean Wilson. And there's a quote from this book that I want to read. It says, the purpose of any ceremony is to build stronger relationship or bridge the distance between our cosmos and us. The research that we do as Indigenous people is a ceremony that allows us a raised level of consciousness and insight into our world. Through going forward together with open minds and good hearts, we have uncovered the nature of this ceremony. And as soon as I heard research as ceremony or like learning ceremonies, the concept of that really jives with me because they seem like such disparate ideas in my head. And I can feel in me this pull towards things that feel contradictory, because often if you dig in a little bit more, they really only feel contradictory because we've been conditioned to think about them in certain ways. So research and ceremony, I had never previously heard put together. Like research, when I think about how to research, I think about people's study routines, reading habits. The most like community-oriented aspect of research that I automatically think of is like a Socratic seminar. But thinking of research and learning as ceremony kind of starts to automatically reframe things in my head and make the process feel more communal. And I think that that is, we'll get to it in a second, but that's a big piece of the difference between colonized education that's like super individualistic and a practice that's more rooted in Indigenous wisdom, restorative justice, that sort of thing. So Dalia calls this series of learning ceremonies the Lighthouse Learning Method. And there are three what she calls learning spirals within the Lighthouse Learning Method. And I want to dig into each one, but just to define what a learning spiral even is, she says the child's natural curiosity is the lesson plan. Learning spirals are intentional, healing-centered spaces where a child's interests, culture, and purpose become education. Instead of forcing subjects onto children, we follow their fascinations and discover how every passion naturally contains all the learning they need. The magic. One strong interest has the potential to be holistic, life-giving education. When a child becomes obsessed with something, that desire is their curriculum calling. Learning spirals help us recognize and nurture the depth already present in their interests. Learning spirals mirror nature in the way we learn. Question, try, reflect, express. And she's talking about how you can implement this for your children, but I saw this and I was like, I want to do this for myself. So the interest spiral, you can think of these spirals as like a project, a month-long experience that you're taking yourself through. The interest spiral is basically taking one interest or obsession and fully saying yes to it. And that becomes the curriculum. So you start to engage in books, movies, TV shows, experiences, talk to experts about this thing that you're so obsessed with. So the example she uses for children is dinosaurs. If a kid is like obsessed with dinosaurs, then they start reading books about dinosaurs. They start watching documentaries about them. They start digging for fossils, that sort of thing. And this naturally becomes, as you go deeper and deeper into that interest, interdisciplinary. So you can learn a lot about science and geology and whatnot when you're learning about dinosaurs, but you can also learn about how to write about the dinosaurs, how to draw pictures of the dinosaurs, how to measure fossils, how to speak to other people about dinosaurs. And she breaks this down into a 4-week experience. So the first week, you're just immersing yourself completely in this interest. And then the second week, you start to create something from your findings. The third week is about connection. So new threads of interests will be popping up as you're deep diving into this first interest. So you can start to ask yourself, what is this making me more curious about? And follow those threads for the next interest spiral. And then the fourth week is integration. So this is going out and sharing what you've learned with your community in some way. It's celebrating the fact that you've learned it. And when I decided to do this, it was interesting because I do feel like I've been allowing myself to go down rabbit holes and get really deep with my interests in a way that I never really have before in my life because of this podcast. And I feel like the interest spiral is actually something I have been doing for myself. But the next two spirals, the ancestor wisdom spiral and the community care spiral, are things that I really haven't implemented yet, specifically in regards to the learning process. And I'm excited to experiment with them a little bit and see what they can add to the process for me. Because I can tell you, I haven't been following this exact like timeline that she has laid out, but I have been going down my own interest spirals because of Wild Geese for the past year. And it has been so incredibly generative for my life and my like sense of personhood and well-being. And I highly, highly recommend implementing that. But these next two just like deepen the process in a way that I really appreciate. Also, I've been seeing a lot of people say that this process sounds a lot like the Montessori education. And I don't really know that much about Montessori, but I do think that these next two spirals are different than what Montessori talks about. Like the Montessori framework, from my understanding, is about like following your interests and having that shape your curriculum. But these next two spirals really deepen beyond that. And just to ground this in how you can be doing this as an adult, I decided that for my learning spiral, I read Braiding Sweetgrass, and I've talked about Braiding Sweetgrass many times in this podcast, but I read it a couple of years ago, and there has been like an underlying sort of fascination with plants and ecology that I have never fully fleshed out beyond reading that book. So I picked up this book called The Light Eaters, which is about the scientific debate around plant intelligence, that sort of thing. And I've been going down YouTube rabbit holes, talking to all of my friends about plant intelligence. So that's my current interest spiral. Okay, the next learning ceremony is the ancestor wisdom spiral. So this is rooting the things that you're learning in a lineage. So this is asking questions about, what did my great grandparents do? What were they interested in? How can that be integrated in my life in some way? So for ecology, it's like, okay, were my great grandparents gardening? If so, what were they gardening? Where were they gardening? What skills were passed down in our family? What wisdom do our ancestors carry? And there's a piece that the community-based global learning collaborative put out called How Can We Practice Decolonization? What Makes an Initiative Decolonial? And it says the very foundations of our written histories are colonized. School textbooks provide a selective retelling of what happened and why, often from the sole perspective of the power holders throughout history, settlers, colonizers, and even academics. One dimension of decolonization is correcting these partial histories. In her book, Connected Sociologies, Gurminder Bhambra, a professor of postcolonial and decolonial studies at the University of Sussex, advocates for correcting partial histories with a deconstruct, reconnect, and reconstruct approach to create a history that not only critically examines the role of enslavement and oppression, but also gives space to incorporate overlooked histories, the people written out of history, many of whom had expansive societies before colonization. The reconnect and reconstruct aspects make an effort to acknowledge marginalized cultures and their resilience and complexity beyond their classification as colonized subjects. So doing something like the ancestor wisdom spiral can help with that deconstruct, reconnect, reconstruct process, and it can root you to a history that you maybe felt previously severed from. If you're white and the idea of connecting with your ancestors makes you nervous and feels uncomfortable because of the probability of a problematic history, I think this is actually an essential thing to move through, because this like severing from our past, our lineage, any sense of culture is a function of white supremacy. And if you want to read more about what I'm referring to, there's an essay on Substack called Turning Towards the Wound, Examining Unprocessed Grief in White European Descended Settlers and Finding Ancestrally Supported Pathways Back to Wholeness by Stevie J. Gould. I'm not going to go super deep into that right now, but if you're white, I definitely recommend giving that a read. And this ancestral wisdom spiral is a new concept for me, so I haven't fully like dove in yet to find resources on how to do all of this beyond just talking to my family members. If you're not connected with your family or it's hard to find information about your ancestors, I would love for people in the comments to give any tips on better ways to connect. One way that I can think is, if you even have a general idea of your ancestry, you can start to read like folk tales and figure out what stories may have been passed around. And also just like pinpointing certain ways that you were lied to in school, because we were like genuinely lied to about certain things. Christopher Columbus, they told us he was like such a nice guy and discovered America and whatever. Like, we do have to deconstruct. So I think deconstruction is a good place to start. And then finally, the community care spiral. So Dahlia shares some questions to ask yourself for step one. Ask yourself, what does your community need? How can your family's gifts serve others? and what problems do you see in your community that you care about? And then you would go about planning and executing some sort of aligned action in your community, whether that's with a mutual aid group, putting together some sort of event, facilitating a community circle. And again, for this community care spiral, she talks about how this becomes interdisciplinary very fast without you even really needing to try, because you've got things that come into play like budgeting, data collection, that's math. And then science, maybe you're forming a hypothesis and testing solutions. Social studies comes into play because you've got that civic engagement. You're literally doing hands-on social justice, restorative justice work. Language arts comes into play because you've got to work on your communication skills. Arts comes into play because maybe you've got to make a flyer for whatever event you're doing. You've got to form some sort of community engagement tools. I'll have this resource linked in the episode description. I recommend going ahead and downloading it because Dahlia has more information there about how to actually like break this down step by step to do it for yourself or do it for your children if you have children. But I read this paper called It Feels Fake, Decolonizing Curriculum and Pedagogy in Predominantly White Institutions. And it basically was three writers telling stories about their experience trying to decolonize predominantly white institutions. And we're not talking about this in the context of an institution, so I'm not going to speak too much about the paper, but they did kind of encapsulate what re-indigenizing educational practices is supposed to look like. And they said, broadly speaking, indigenous epistemologies emphasize wholeness, physical, emotional, spiritual, and intellectual, interconnectedness to land in all its form and entities, and relationship with others, family, communities, and nations. Knowledge in this holistic framework tends to be both subjectively determined and collectively accountable. Indigenous scholars see knowledge as fundamentally relational and community as the primary setting for Indigenous education. This might be referred to as what Kovac calls self in relation, because it frames knowledge as a co-production related and development of ourselves in relation to others. So when we think about self-led learning as adults, I think we often picture very isolated practices, and I'm including myself in that. I mean, I'm alone in my room recording these episodes. I'm alone in my room researching for these episodes. I'm very alone during this process. And so that's why I think that the ancestral wisdom spiral and the community care spiral are really lovely ways to weave community and relationship into this process. So that's just a quick rundown of the Lighthouse Learning Method and learning ceremonies. I want to go back to the interest spiral, the first one that we were talking about, for a second, though, because that's really where most of my expertise lies. I'm still so new to the ancestral piece of this. I wouldn't say that I'm new to community care, but I'm not as good at it as I am at the interest part of things. So I'm going to dive into the interest spiral even further and give you some tools for information retention, annotating your books, how to read more, that sort of thing. So for information retention, a thing that I still feel like I'm not amazing at, I can retain big picture things very easily. It's very hard for me to retain small details. But I saw something posted by Girls School Books on TikTok, who has her master's thesis in metaphor. And she said that your brain actually doesn't store information in isolation. It stores information in relationships, which just makes the learning ceremonies thing make even more sense to me. So she talks about a way to get this relational memory flowing is to read books in pairs. So to have one book that's like a fictional novel on a subject, and then to have another book paired with it that is a nonfiction like theory book. So like I said, I picked up this book, The Light Eaters, and after I saw that video, I was like, oh, I should read this in relationship to something, because that is a nonfiction book about scientific findings that botanists and zoologists are making around this idea of plant behavior, plant intelligence, and why plant intelligence is such a controversial idea in the scientific world. Very interesting book, but I was like, oh, okay, so I should pair this with something fictional. So I asked people on my Instagram story what would be a good pair, and a lot of people said the book Annihilation. I think you're just basically trying to get two books, one theory nonfiction, one fiction novel, that are in conversation in some thematic way. So like another example would be if I went and read Frankenstein, I would maybe want to pair that with a novel about the history of monsters. If you wanted to do an interest spiral about like society's depictions of girlhood, I would maybe read like My Brilliant Friend by Elena Ferrante and then pair it with Girlhood by Melissa Phoebos. And also watch Pin 15 while you're at it. Just got like psychotically cold in my room. So new character unlocked, I guess. Anyways, another way to retain information is to annotate your books. And I never used to do this. I remember in high school being told to annotate my books, and I thought that just meant like underlying metaphors and similes and personification. and like labeling the different like devices that I saw. And I was like, how is this supposed to add to the experience of reading for me? It doesn't make any sense. Why would I annotate? But I saw a video that completely reframed my thought process around this. And obviously, I have a whole episode on digital gardening. I know that note taking is very helpful and it has been very helpful, but I wasn't taking physical notes in my books until a couple of months ago. And it's because I saw a video by Safana on TikTok, who makes amazing videos about writing and copywriting and how psychology is used to get people to buy things and even to make people complicit in things like genocide. She is incredibly, incredibly smart. And she has this whole video that I'll have linked that breaks down her process for annotating. But one thing she said that has always stuck with me is that she reads books as if the author is speaking directly to her. And if someone was speaking directly to you for 100 pages straight, there's no way that you would actually just agree with everything that they're saying. And this is so true. I feel like in the past, when I've opened books, I've kind of automatically been giving away a lot of my, like, I don't know, intellectual integrity. That's not really the word that I'm looking for, but we'll say that as soon as I open the book, because I'm assuming that this author is this big expert in whatever they're talking about. And I'm just there to absorb the information they're giving me, not to actually be in conversation with it. So she will write in the margins as if she's responding directly to the author. And this just makes sure that she is an active participant in the conversation. So I've started to do this too. And I had a really cool experience with this book. I'm still not as active and intense about annotating as I want to be, but I'm getting there. We're all starting wherever we are, whatever. But basically, there's so much debate around this concept of plant intelligence because there are things that plants do that keep them alive, obviously, as like these rooted beings. They have evolved in a way that reacts to their environment in a way that some people would call intelligent, but a lot of scientists are really, really wary of that term, especially because plants don't have neurons. Plants don't have a brain that we have found. But there was a study that was done that showed how electricity moves through the body of a plant. And I'm not going to get into the specifics. I think you should go and read this book if you're interested in this conversation. But I read about the study and I remember writing in the margins, oh my God, it sounds like the entire plant is a brain. And I, as I was writing it, I was like, that is so stupid. I am an idiot for thinking that. But I wrote it anyway. And then a couple pages later, the conversation had like veered off. And I was like, oh, I'm like actually dumb for even writing that, like for having that thought. I'm so stupid. And I almost went back in my own book with my own annotations that nobody is looking over. No professor is going to be looking through this. I almost went back and scratched it out because I was like, that's so stupid for me to even think that. But once I got to the end of the chapter, there was a section where the author of the book was having a conversation with a scientist who's like the dean of a university. And the author posed the question to the scientist, could the whole plant be something like a brain? And it says the scientist leaned in a little and dropped her voice to a whisper and said, I think you're right. She said, I just don't talk about it. And I was like, holy shit. I was so glad that I wrote down that thought because when I originally thought it, I so quickly gaslit myself into thinking it was a stupid thought to have. If I was reading this without like having a conversation with the author in the margins, who knows if I would have even given myself credit for having that thought. This feels like a huge tangent, and I hope I'm making sense, but I think the ability to trace back your thoughts and be in active conversation with the author can also sometimes show you that you're pretty damn smart, and you don't have to discount that just because someone else wrote this book, not you. You might have really smart questions that other people are asking. You might come to smart conclusions, but also annotating is a really good place to learn. So anything that you're learning, if there's a word that you don't know or a theory that you've never heard of, taking a moment to go and Google it and then write it down on like a post-it note that you can put on the side of the book, which I have obviously not started doing, but this is a piece of Safana's advice, is to have post-it notes coming out of the side of your book that are the things that you're learning, and then post-it notes at the top of the book with key takeaways that you could then go and teach other people so that you could then teach the book after reading it. And any moments in the book that you feel just completely changed your own brain chemistry, you can note that down in a post-it and put it at the front of the book, associated with its page number. So then at the very front of the book, next time you open up this book a year from now, you'll automatically be confronted with all of those moments that you felt really changed something for you, instead of having to flip back through the whole thing. If you're listening to an audiobook, you can do the same thing with like a digital garden. And finally, if you're looking for free resources to learn more, Sarah Schauer has a great Substack post that has a lot of websites linked where you can go take free courses, find free academic articles. I know with JSTOR, you can read 100 academic articles for free. Even Wikipedia. Wikipedia is such a great resource. We really do have so many rich, free resources at our disposal, but it's just the light, short stuff that's like trapping us in this cycle where it's getting harder and harder to get out and really learn something new. So I hope you took something away from this episode. I'm really excited about trying out some of these learning ceremonies and seeing how it works for myself. If you do it, please let me know how it goes for you. It's always so interesting to me to see what rabbit holes other people are going down. So please let me know. And I don't know, like, subscribe, comment, whatever. I'll see you in 2 weeks. Bye.